It is time for Plan A with Rebecca Davis. You see, Rebecca, I've taken our inability to get the day of the right day of the week correct. I've taken it into my inability to get the letter of the alphabet correct as well.
I see so, John.
Yes. Fascinating what waiting to see what the former Chief Justice Mogoeng is going to do. Is he going to apologize for his remarks about Israel and Palestine, or is he going to double down, maybe take the matter on review to the courts, which he used to be the boss of?
Well, I think strongly that he won't apologize based on the fact that he doubled down already. You might recall initially straight after the whole controversy, he said that he would not apologize if people marched against him every day for 50,000 years or something similarly hyperbolic. So, yes, he has until next week, I think, Mogoeng, the former Chief Justice, for remarks he made about South Africa's relationship with Israel after the Judicial Conduct Committee found that he had breached the Judicial Code of Conduct by becoming involved in a political controversy and also by behaving in a way that was incompatible with the necessary independence required of a judge. John, the wider question is, though, how do we expect judges to behave? And are those expectations still reasonable? You know, we have this view that they should be effectively the head boys and head girls of society sort of until death. I mean, a member of the local legal world once told me that certain local judges of his acquaintance find it unseemly even for judges to wear shorts in public, which kind of blew my mind. So the former Chief Justice Mogoeng, in his defense of this whole controversy, actually launched quite a strong appeal for judges to be seen also as citizens who have fundamental rights and freedoms. In fact, he actually said that, in his view, judges and magistrates should be encouraged to speak publicly on strong opinions they have about virtually anything in order to allow for more transparency when it comes to their judgments. In other words, so that then we, the public, can look at their judgments and say, oh, well, he's clearly influenced by his own bias towards X, Y, and Z. And the issue has also been kind of in the spotlight lately with regards to Judge Raymond Zondo, who, of course, stood up and defended the judiciary in the wake of attacks by the tourism minister, Lindy Wisisulu, for which he was also criticized, sort of because of the same idea that judges basically should say as little as possible in public outside of the ambit of their formal judgments. I'm interested in this because our history is quite mixed on this front. So the former Deputy Chief Justice Dikgang Moseneke, for instance, gave a lecture in the U.S. a few years ago in which he expressed strong frustration with the government's apparent inability to comply with court orders. And apparently members of the executive were kind of enraged by that at the time, which is also seen as kind of unbecoming. But then on the other hand, we have the views of someone like the former Judge Edwin Cameron, who said that judicial officers actually have a responsibility to speak out about issues of injustice and social inequity and so forth, particularly in situations like apartheid. We have this kind of bizarre situation where some interpretations of judicial conduct are so extreme that, for instance, I think a few years ago, again, it was questioned whether a South African judge could even be a supporter of the SPCA on the grounds that animal rights cases might come before them, and this might kind of skew their interpretation. But it's also been pointed out that someone like Edwin Cameron, for instance, has been allowed throughout his judicial career, as well as before it, to be very outspoken on the notion of gay rights, not the notion, the reality of gay rights, at the same time as presiding over cases involving gay rights to do with home affairs, for instance. So where do we draw the line? I have to admit, I sort of have a bit of sympathy for Mogoeng in this regard, simply because I feel that judges, whether retired or in active service, actually, we assume, have fairly vast repositories of knowledge and wisdom on certain matters that I think as a public we would benefit from. So I would be all for judges being allowed to behave and act with greater freedom. And I guess the fundamental question, to quote one legal scholar, is whether it's reasonable these days to expect judges to behave like priests in plain clothes. My view is not really.
Very much my view as well. I mean, one judge you didn't mention is Dennis Davis, and I think public debate in South Africa would be considerably poorer if it were not for the fact that Dennis Davis, he's now retired as a judge, but he spent all those years as a judge, more than 20, close to 25 years, I think it was, as a judge, and he said many things outside of a courtroom that were very, very important to hear and to debate. And what happens a lot, it seems to me, Rebecca, is that if you don't agree with what the judge says outside of the courtroom, then you raise a stink about it. So the ANC Youth League made a stink about what Moseneke said on his 60th birthday, which was something as simple and harmless as is not what the ANC wants. It's about what is good for our people, and was much pilloried for that. And the same is true, I think, of most of the criticisms of judges. It comes from people who are discomforted by the remarks the judge has made.
And you're certainly right there, and also the topics and their kind of political volatility. I mean, there's no doubt that Mogoeng would not even be in this circumstance, I think, if he had opined publicly on something like the conflict in northern Ethiopia or even the Ukraine, possibly. I mean, it is that kind of context-dependent, I suspect.
And then a very interesting study which suggests that the parents of teenage girls are more likely to get divorced than the parents of teenage boys. That immediately feels counterintuitive. You immediately think boys are much more troubled than girls, therefore parents are much more likely to disagree about how to raise boys than they are to disagree about how to raise girls, and so therefore more likely to have those disagreements spill over into divorce proceedings.
It's so interesting that you say that, John, because I read that. I mean, one headline was even, it's not a new study, by the way. It's been around in some form since 2014. In fact, there's quite a few studies suggesting this. One headline was, teenage daughters are a risk factor for divorce. I read that, and my immediate gut response was, yep, makes sense to me. I think that's because I've been a teenage girl.
And so I've been a teenage boy a long time ago, but I was.
But I also know firsthand the kind of little balls of malice that teenage girls can be and the attendant strain that must put on many partnerships. Look, they're not entirely sure what the reason is for why teenage daughters might be more of a risk factor for divorce. So there's some suggestion that it may be highly sexist and patriarchal attitudes, like that fathers are just more likely to be invested in a family with sons than with daughters and are more likely to sort of bugger off, if you'll pardon my language, if they are girls. But it is also what you just said, that parents of teenage daughters have more disagreements apparently over child rearing. That, you know, questions like how you should allow your daughter to dress or how she can most safely go out into the world, which understandably causes stress for many parents, simply may spill over into, you know, genuine divorce actionable proceedings. And another very interesting aspect of this, John, is that there's some suggestion that fathers who had sisters growing up or have sisters are not as likely to leave a marriage with a teenage daughter. So there's definitely some correlation, perhaps, between your own kind of immersion in a world of females and your tolerance towards your own teenage daughters. Either way, very, very interesting. And also shouldn't be, you know, I mean, if you're listening to this, you're the parents of a teenage daughter, you shouldn't assume that your marriage will end in divorce. The difference in statistical likelihood is actually very, very small, but it is a reality nonetheless.
And the difference between daughters, sons, and pigeon pairs, is that spelled out at all anywhere in what you've read?
It is not, John. Is this an invitation for me to talk about new species?
No, it's not. I am going to get to that. But I mean, in terms of daughters, boys, and a daughter, daughters, sons, and a daughter and a son, whether there is any difference in... Because that's known as a pigeon pair, what it was when I was growing up.
There is some suggestion that the effect is more pronounced if the firstborn is a daughter rather than the firstborn is a son. And also don't forget that overwhelmingly, I think, statistical analysis finds that child-free couples tend to report higher qualities of life, which I'm sure is no surprise to anyone who is a parent. Maybe that is the ultimate answer, but don't tell the Pope.
And now on to monkeys. I always love it when things that fascinate me seem to equally fascinate people for whom I have very high regard, as I have very high regard for you. So I'm delighted that you are as excited as I am about the discovery as a new species of a ghostly monkey.
That's right. And it's not just a ghostly monkey. It's 224 new species found last year in the Mekong region alone, which takes in vast swathes of Southeast Asia, Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, and I think a few other places. 224 new species. I mean, I thought that was absolutely amazing, John, in this environment where we're constantly told everything's going extinct, that we still haven't even begun to finish tabulating the things on this earth that already exist. So the 224 species includes only one new mammal, which is precisely what you said, a monkey with ghostly white circles around its eyes, kind of cool looking. It also includes quite a creepy looking new newt and a ginger plant called stink bug. Now, my immediate response, John, was that none of these particularly sound like things we humans would love to keep in our homes, which hopefully means they might be safe from human predation. But when it comes to the ghostly monkey, I believe it went immediately from being discovered onto the endangered list. So I think my optimism may be slightly misplaced.
And now on to, for many people, the most important of the four topics we're discussing this afternoon. What is the proper way to eat Weet-Bix?
John, you know, I'm so grateful at times like this that we have public platforms in order to use them in this kind of necessary and responsible way. So the context of this is that yesterday, for the first time in many, many years, I bought Weet-Bix at the shop. I brought it home, and my partner, Haji, asked me if I would prepare her a bowl. So I brought it to her, and she looked at me with suspicion and said, "How did you make that so fast?" I said, "I wasn't making Christmas lunch. It was Weet-Bix. I just did what everyone does with Weet-Bix. I took a brick, I popped it in a bowl, and I poured some milk on it." John.
Oh, dear.
She looked at me honestly as if I had just confessed to flushing the cat down the toilet or something, and informed me this was so brutally wrong a way to make Weet-Bix that she almost couldn't compute. In her view, the correct and only way to make Weet-Bix is that first you splash some hot or boiling water onto the bricks to soften them up. Then you add milk. Then you take the bowl and put it in the microwave to further heat up the milk. Then you add sugar. Then you mush it into a kind of ProNutro consistency. And only then do you even begin to think about eating it. John. To say I was taken aback would be putting it mildly. So I promptly did what any responsible person would do and embarked on a small survey of my friends and colleagues. And I found, to my shock and horror, that the world appears to be pretty much evenly split between people who say that the right way to eat Weet-Bix is to heat it and mush it, and those who, like me, contend the correct way to eat Weet-Bix is to pour cold water over it in order to allow it to maintain a crunchy texture. Because my point, which I think is very hard to refute, is if what you want is a mushy paste, why on earth wouldn't you just eat ProNutro or Maltavella or any one of the numerous cereals available which are intended to be prepared in this manner? The whole point of Weet-Bix, surely, is that it has this crunchy texture. Am I wrong?
It's probably 60 years since I last had Weet-Bix, so I'm not somebody who can offer even an inexpert opinion on something which I'm sure has our listeners scratching their heads at the moment. The first contribution comes from a listener which says, boiling water over Weet-Bix, then cold milk and sugar. John, I'll keep this short. I eat butter on my Weet-Bix like a slice of bread. Failing that, Rebecca's way is the way, not the mush. Cold milk only, says somebody very confidently.